good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we'll hear more from Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund organizer Kai Hushky from Spokane, who spoke with activists in Moscow February 1st about ways to combat corporate political hegemony in communities and about a possible community bill of rights. But first, this news. Three lawmakers in the U.S. House introduced the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act today in Washington, D.C., which would protect 23 million acres in five states as wilderness. Co-sponsor Democratic Representative Carolyn Mahoney of New York said, by connecting whole ecosystems, NARIPA helps preserve native plants and animals by protecting these natural habitats and mitigating the impact of climate change for current and future generations of Americans. Another co-sponsor is Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona, who is the ranking Democrat on the House Subcommittee on Public Lands and Environmental Regulation. Grijalva said, with sequestration cutting everything in sight, it's time to start thinking about places we shouldn't be cutting. The Northern Rockies should be at the top of the list. The other co-sponsor is Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts. The Idaho Revenue and Taxation Committee passed a measure today which would give tax credits to people who want to donate to private and religious schools. Supporters in the committee say the bill will give patrons a choice over whether to enroll their kids in public or private schools. The money would go directly to scholarship funds for students attending private schools. The money is expected to be enough to allow about 3,000 students to attend private schools, which traditionally are more expensive than public institutions. Republican Bob Nonini of Coeur d'Alene sponsored the bill. Nonini said the plan may actually save Idaho money by reducing the number of publicly enrolled students and cutting the funds needed to operate the schools. Nonini added his bill was carefully written so it does not use public funds for religious schools. He said the Idaho Attorney General's office has assured him there is no conflict with the state constitution's prohibition of spending public money on religious education. Democrat Grant Burgoyne of Boise said his opposition comes from a desire to keep church and state separate. Burgoyne said the measure may look as if there's no conflict. He said, it's wrongheaded to give credits to a religious institution, and a judge may agree with that. Public money shifted to a religious school is unconstitutional, Burgoyne told the committee. Our destiny is with our public schools. Supporters of the measure include LAM Christian Academy founder Shelley Matthews from Coeur d'Alene. Matthews said her school is restricted by the economy. She said the cost of attending her school amounts to over $4,500 per year and is not affordable for many of those who want their children enrolled in a private school. Matthews said, when the numbers go down, when the economy is difficult, our numbers go down, and we have to adjust our budget. This is a kind of bill that could help those parents. Opposition came from the Idaho Education Association, whose leaders say the bill is nothing more than a way to direct funding to religious schools. One committee Republican representative opposed the measure. Referring to public schools, Neil Anderson of Blackfoot said, the more we take money from them, the more they come to resemble a ghost town. We ought to work on sustaining our communities. Let's take care of our town, not abandon it in favor of one over the ridge. The bill now moves to the full House for debate. The Idaho House unanimously passed a bill yesterday which would require open contract negotiations between teachers and schools. According to the Idaho Statesman, the bill, which passed on a 61-0 vote, would make teachers' collective bargaining public and would make minutes and contract offers open under state records laws. The measure is supported by the Idaho Education Association and the Idaho School Board Association. The two groups have been on opposite sides in testimony over other bills this session, which bring back Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Luna's Students Come First laws. which were defeated in last November's election by a large margin. The measure now goes to the governor's desk for his signature. The sponsor of a bill that would require a warrant for police to use drones for spying says the bill will likely be amended to give more flexibility for state and local police forces. Bill sponsor Senator Chuck Winder of Boise said the language being considered would exempt police and search and rescue teams from the judicial warrant requirement if the searches are lawful. The original version of the bill exempted police from the warrant requirement when searching for marijuana growing operations. Winder, who is a Republican, is also the senator who sponsored a non-binding resolution opposing the legalization of marijuana, quote, for any purpose. That bill passed in the Senate 29-5 on February 26th and now goes before the House State Affairs Committee. The Idaho State Journal reports a Bannock County Sheriff's deputy killed 30-year-old Bradley Allen Wilson last night after Wilson apparently was in the process of taking someone hostage at a pet store in Chubbuck. Chubbuck Police Chief Randy Severe said his officers were asked to check on Wilson's well-being, and when they found him in a parked car, he pulled out a gun and sped away. Bannock County deputies, Pocatello and Chubbuck Police, and Idaho State Police responded when they heard a report Wilson had taken someone hostage at the Chubbuck Petco store. Severe said the deputy who shot Wilson determined the hostage was in imminent danger. Wilson was killed after being shot in the neck once. Bannock County Sheriff Lauren Nelson told the Journal the Bingham County Sheriff's Department will lead an investigation into the incident. The Idaho Department of Health and Welfare has organized a week-long regional law enforcement training session for how to deal with mentally ill people in a crisis situation. Clearwater County Sheriff's Department Chief Deputy Rick Miller told the Lewiston Tribune the training will follow the Memphis model of using a crisis intervention team. Miller said the training will teach law enforcement officers what is going on in people's minds with different mental illness issues. Miller said if a person commits a crime, they still commit a crime, but initially you can get the treatment they need and get them taken care of and going down the right road before you deal with a jail situation. The training will start Monday, March 25th at the State Hospital North in Orofino with instruction from a staff psychologist at the hospital. The rest of the week's classes will be held at the Valley Christian Center in Lewiston and will include acted out crisis scenarios with actors playing mentally ill people. After nearly 3 hours of testimony, the Idaho House Transportation Committee yesterday postponed action until next week on legislation that would allow trucks weighing up to 129,000 pounds on highways around the state. The bill would give local highway districts the option of designating routes for the heavier trucks, but under the bill, the Idaho Transportation Department would be making the call on all state highways. The bill was proposed by the Idaho Forest Group, which owns 5 sawmills in the northern part of the state. Forest Group Vice President Robert Boa said he thinks the bill will help his and other companies to be more competitive in the regional and global market. The current limits on most Idaho roads is 80,000 pounds, and that can increase to 105,500 pounds with a permit. Many industries say 129,000 pound loads would help in cutting costs for transporting goods. KBC Transport co-owner Wally Burchak opposed the bill, saying, "There isn't a person in this room who can say this won't compromise safety. I'm the only one who's testified today who's in the transportation business. All individuals who are trying to push this through don't run trucks up and down the highway." The legislation has already received approval in the Senate. The House Transportation Committee will continue to hear testimony next week before voting on the bill. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, Idaho's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate held steady at 6.3% in January. The Idaho Department of Labor announced the news this morning in Boise. The data also shows a 400-person decline in the state's labor force. The Department of Labor's analysts say they are concerned about the state's slow economic recovery and believe that a larger economic recovery for Idaho will be slow and arduous. The department says a larger recovery is reliant on a sufficient workforce to help businesses grow the state economy. Until January, Idaho employers were slowly increasing the labor force by hiring more workers during most of last year. The statewide drop in unemployed workers matched the labor force decline, keeping the unemployment rate unchanged from December to January. This marks the smallest December through January employment gain since the early 1980s, when employment declined in much larger numbers. The nation's jobless rate was 7.8% last month. Washington State University Provost Warwick Bailey announced yesterday he will resign effective May 31st after nearly 5 years in the position. Bailey said he wants to return to full-time research in the field of equine exercise science and will remain a professor at the university. Bailey said he started at WSU 34 years ago because his type of research is there, and he said he doesn't know of a better place to research equine exercise. Bailey became provost after serving as the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine for 7 years. Bailey said it's time for someone else to be the chief academic officer at WSU. He said provosts typically serve 4 years. The Washington Supreme Court yesterday rejected a petition from convicted serial killer Robert Yates of Spokane to overturn his pending execution. The petition claimed numerous instances of jury bias, ineffective counsel, and procedural errors. Yates was sentenced to 408 years in prison after he pled guilty in 2000 to killing 13 women in Spokane tied to prostitution. A Tacoma jury sentenced him to death in 2002 for killing two other women in Pierce County. He is currently on death row at Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. Yates' attorneys argued prosecutors in Pierce County should have honored the plea deal reached in Spokane that prevented the implementation of the death penalty for the 13 murders there. They also argued Green River killer Gary Ridgway was given life sentences for the murders of 49 people that he pled guilty to. The Washington Senate voted 47-2 this week to require all products containing asbestos sold in the state to be labeled. Asbestos was banned between 1989 and 1991 in the U.S., but home remodeling supply manufacturers have been using it in some products since then without labeling it. In some cases, asbestos is listed as mineral fibers or chrysotile. The bill, sponsored by Democratic Senator Andy Billig of Spokane, now goes to the House. A survey of Washington high school students shows they are twice as likely to smoke marijuana than cigarettes. The survey shows student cigarette smoking has decreased across the state. Nearly 30% of high school students in Washington said in the survey they use or have used pot in the last 30 days. Washington State Health Secretary Mary Selecki said she is concerned current marijuana prevention efforts are not going to increase in response to the new state law legalizing adult marijuana use. Part of the tax revenue from pot sales is expected to go to youth prevention education, but Selecki says the cannabis stores will open before the new money can go into prevention programs. The survey also found that fewer students are consuming alcohol compared to 2010. We now go to our featured segment. Spokane organizer for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, Kai Hushke, spoke to a group of Moscow activists February 1st about what communities can do to combat overwhelming corporate power and the possibility of enacting Community Bill of Rights. Last week we heard a segment of Hushke's talk, and today we'll hear another part.
I use the mechanisms that are so designed around the corporation. The United States is a corporation. The government is a corporation. Therefore, the corporations, how do you use those mechanisms to try and defeat corporatocracy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think I think that's where the lawmaking piece comes into play, which is the biggest difference, I think, between other kinds of activism and this sort of community activism that's happening. So in essence, it's using that the structure of law against the current structure of law. Okay, it's about challenging that. What's that?
In the courts, fighting court battles.
Partially.
Against the structure of the law.
Partially, yeah. I mean, there may be coming a point. So, for instance, on the state constitutional change stuff in Pennsylvania, as an example, since they're the most sort of advanced in this, there may become a decision about, you know, do we do this within the jurisdiction of what's set up for us, or do we actually set out and do something extra jurisdictional? Because if the structure isn't going to validate our chance to actually address the true injustices, we may need to set up separate structures in order to do that.
Is that illegal?
Yes, just in the same way that the Revolutionaries' Act of the Declaration of Independence was wholesale illegal. It was also illegal was the fact when we had our first constitution, when the Constitutional Convention, of which we revere today in our history books, their charge was just about amending the Articles of Confederation. In essence, those folks broke the law to then design what we see as the U.S. Constitution, or what we see as the second Constitution. So in some ways, again, we have precedents to say, what if we're not getting the remedy, if the system itself is that bad or that unjust, how far are we willing to go around actually changing that? In some cases, it's come to the actually breaking the law in order to change the law.
When that occurred originally, the institutions that were already in place considered the new revolution of ideas as terrorist. Recently, laws have been enacted to scare us. Would not something like that, being you disassociated with the corporate state, the structure, all those kinds of things, aren't you then an organization which is organized against a revolution, against the way things are, and is that not a form of terrorism legally currently?
I don't know about legally, but it's definitely something that comes out. There's a community I'm working with in Oregon that is trying to put forward a food bill of rights. So in essence, to advocate for a sustainable food system, in the process saying no to what they see as unsustainable agriculture, specifically genetic modification of crops and the pesticides that go with it. In Oregon, when you file, you have to go through what's called a single subject review. And so the first step is, does what you propose actually have connective? Is there a rational, logical view of what you're putting forward? Does it all connect? Does it all make sense? Or are you trying to jam multiple issues into one document? So they go over this review, and the cases that stands today hasn't been decided yet, but the county, so in this case it was the county, against citizens of their own county that filed one of these judgments in this particular appeal case. And within that, there's in their ordinance, it talks about this idea of the sovereignty of the people. And the sovereignty of the people really is polling on their own constitution. So in Oregon's constitution, the first article is about all political powers inherent in the people. And the reason why that's there is to get out from underneath Dillon's rule. When we peel back Dillon's rule more, Dillon's rule is about the municipal corporation. So that your city is a municipal corporation. Dillon's rule is about controlling the municipal corporation. And this is about making a sharp distinction between the people and the municipal corporation. So in essence, if the municipal corporation isn't acting on behalf of the people, then what's the point of the municipal corporation? So within that the county made the accusation that what the folks were proposing there, that the FBI would deem them as domestic terrorists. So yes, I mean, folks get labeled as being terrorists for actually, in this case, advocating for a food system and actually advocating for this idea that if government isn't about the people, then what's the point of government? And yes, the system will do what it wants, in essence, to try to label people as being terrorists or Marxists or socialists or something, in essence. Now, whether they're technically legally that or not, you know, I don't think so. But the labeling of that happens all the time.
Could you be arrested for coming to a meeting such as this?
No.
They couldn't?
No.
Not like the Communist Party?
No. I think what that particular case points out, again, is what the system is willing to go to keep us in the box. And the other thing around doing the lawmaking piece, again, that's different than the civil disobedience we may do individually, is we move ourselves out from underneath the police state kind of stuff. You know, you stand in front of the megalodes, you're going to get arrested, and then you have to deal with the courts around the criminal stuff that you just went under. This stuff is around using either your elected officials or the initiative process to float forward new lawmaking that may get challenged in court, but you move yourself out from underneath the criminal prosecution stuff, okay? So in essence, it's about organizing ourselves differently and more tactically to say, yes, we may need to do the civil disobedience stuff that may still need to be possible in our activism that we're doing, but with this stuff is to say, well, let's move ourselves away from the criminal activity stuff that we have to deal with in going through the courts and the court fines, and actually use something like the initiative process, for instance, to move something forward that then challenges the structure within what it is that we're trying to do locally there. And so you move out from underneath some of that stuff that we wouldn't be able to move out under our own individual personal actions of, let's say, being civil disobedient.
So that worked in Pennsylvania. Maybe we'll work in Pennsylvania. I mean, if an individual, is it working because the county or the city took that action, as opposed to if I say I don't recognize the federal government and their taxation and I don't pay my taxes, I mean, it isn't going to do any good for me to say that. I don't recognize it.
Because So again, you're making a distinction between personal action and collective action. Okay. So in this case, in most cases, it was elected officials on behalf of the people adopting new law. Okay, so they adopt ordinances at the local level that says, this is how this particular world's going to operate around this particular issue area. Let's say it's farming. And within that, we're going to validate the fact that we want clean air and clean water and a sustainable agricultural system, and we're going to reject things that are unsustainable. So the big factory farm stuff we see as unsustainable in our system of what agriculture should be in our community. So now you have this law in hand. And in Pennsylvania's case, there were enough of those passed, as I mentioned, that then the agribusiness industry, the lobbying industry, got a new law passed to then go after those, in essence, to attack those local laws. And within that, the Attorney General, who is now the governor at the time, who's the governor now, Governor Corbett, who was the Attorney General at the time, in one of his briefs against these communities that had this law in place, said very clearly, says there is no inherent right to local self-government. So your own Attorney General is telling you have no self-determination power at the local level. And so where this stuff is kind of new for folks is to say we're not, again, expecting the courts to rule for us. But we are appreciative when the Attorney General says you have no say about what happens in your community, and it's not the Legal Defense Fund saying it or someone else saying it, but it's your own Attorney General telling you you have no inherent right to local self-government. That's the kind of stuff that is about getting people to understand the structural stuff. And so the lawmaking stuff as it stands today, again, isn't looking for the courts to rule in our favor. At the same time, it should be about, and hopefully we'll get to the point where it is about driving thousands of these into the court where they no longer can be ignored, much in the same way that other people's movements can no longer be ignored, and then the congressional folks who were your elected folks apparently then have to make that structural change stuff. So in essence, they can no longer ignore it. If they're not going to pick up the fight and fight with us, we have to actually build enough pressure somehow to get them to no longer ignore the fact that something has to change. And so this is where this community stuff eventually has to build from. We're still at the point where folks have to be willing to do something about it. And again, it's not about the Legal Defense Fund telling you have to do something. That's up to the folks in their own communities. We don't go to places and say, we're going to work here now. We get calls to say, hey, we got this thing going on. We heard about folks in Pennsylvania or folks in Spokane or folks in Las Vegas, New Mexico. And we think, you know, this is something we need to do here. You know, can you help us? That's where we come and help them, you know, help assist them drafting law. We assist them if there's legal stuff that goes on. We help them sort of build towards this understanding that it's not the fracking issue. It's not a GMO issue. It's not a coal issue. It's a decision-making structural issue. It's, in essence, a local self-government issue. To state it another way is we don't have a good enough counterforce to where the power resides currently. And the power is being put in fewer and fewer hands. So what's the counterforce to actually break that? And so this is about, in essence, being able to break where the power resides and get back to this this a place of which we originally tried to do with the Revolutionary War, which was to decentralize some of this decision making, which all came out of the fact they observed the British Empire having so much control over them that they didn't want to live under that same system.
The second time the Spokane Bill of Rights was on the ballot, Community Bill of Rights was on the ballot, it almost won. It was just a few hundred votes.
Awesome.
And then, but the first time it was solidly trounced. And I also heard that the second time around, a lot of the support came from the precincts in Spokane that also voted for Republican legislators.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could reflect a little bit on your success, this relative success the second time.
Yeah, I can give a quick synopsis there, and it's difficult to get a super accurate picture because it's not as if the groups on the ground have the resources to do exit polling and all that stuff that campaigns utilize. But in Spokane, in 2009, the vote was 76-24, 76 no, 24 yes. So in conventional political terms, that's a slaughter. And if you run for office, you have permission never to run for office again when you lose that bad. I mean, that's sort of conventionally how politics works. The folks there, just to kind of give some backstory about why they did it again, is they looked at it and said, you know, holy cow, 13,000 people in the city of Spokane voted for basically a complete re-engineering of what government is about and who government is for, and they saw that as encouragement. Plus, they understood that they were up, you know, it was going to be a 10-year probably battle before anything actually stuck in the city of Spokane. So when it came around again, they shrunk it down. They did some work to it to see what was resonating with folks. And I think the message was pretty simple, which was who should have more decision-making power when it comes to major development in your neighborhood, the corporate developer or are you the neighborhood residents? Or who should have more say about pollution in the river, the corporate polluter, or are you the public that sees the river as a communal thing? Or you, the worker in the workplace, should your corporate employer have more rights to free speech than you as the worker? And so the arguments were made very simple to folks. And then on top of that, the last provision was, should corporations override those rights, or should corporations be subordinate to those community rights that are being put forward? And so folks, I think, looked at that and said, well, it is about self-determination, and somehow we still believe in that, whether we've been told we shouldn't believe in that or not. And so when it came to the vote, it ended up being a 1,000-vote spread. So 501 more votes the other way would have passed the thing. So it went leaps and bounds beyond what it did in 2009. In 2009, the Community Bill of Rights won zero precincts in the city. In 2011, it won more precincts than it lost. And you're right, in some of those areas, there was a gentleman who is very aligned with sort of Tea Party philosophy, all about, you know, government is bad, let's hold back government, no taxes, that kind of mindset. And he won an office on the city council. And in his district, that district voted for the Community Bill of Rights more so than it voted against it. So you had this sort of weird thing around sort of electoral politics with this kind of new question being asked of the people, which is, do you want more decision-making power over these things that you find to be critical in your community? Which is not often what we get asked as voters in our own communities or at the state level or the federal level. It's all deferred to our elected officials to do right for us and so on and so forth. So I think there's that weird kind of stuff going on, even politically in a place like Spokane.
So could you reiterate, what are the four states that are organizing at the state level?
The most advanced is Pennsylvania, so they're actually forming actual chapters around the state. So the interesting thing is getting folks who were working on coal issues or working on fracking issues or working on factory farm issues now to come together to look at state constitutional structural change that doesn't have the issues wrapped on it, but maybe be looking at this right to local self-government, this idea that corporations aren't people under the law and shouldn't have these protections, and then probably also looking at the rights of nature on a state level as three possible planks to push to the state level. New Hampshire's probably sort of second if you want to look at the advancement of this stuff, because a lot of work has happened in the Northeast. Places like New Mexico and Washington, they've formed these community rights networks, but they're not there yet as far as the mobilization. Again, you never know what may push something forward. The idea is to begin to start connecting these communities so they at least can share resources, the understanding that it's not just about what happens in their community, but eventually they got to do the work at the state level, and so it's setting the scene for what we know needs to happen. It's also looking at the fact that in places like Washington, it's your legislators that can only make constitutional change. In Oregon, you can do it by citizens' initiative. Of course, we know at the federal level, it takes two-thirds of Congress and then three-quarters of the states to ratify the Constitution. So if you want to look at how difficult it is to make a change.
That was Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund organizer Kai Hushky of Spokane speaking with activists at the 1912 Center in Moscow February 1st about a possible community bill of rights and ways to combat corporate political hegemony in communities. That's it for this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. If you want to help KRFP, come to the Radio Free Moscow Real Radio Dinner on Saturday, March 23rd. Tickets are available at Book People now, at the station, and at the Radio Free Moscow website. Jim Roach and Craig Wheeler assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great weekend.